Yeah, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to always to come to Perimeter, and it's a real privilege to get to talk about the things that are going on in particle physics now. Obviously, only an infinitesimal fraction of this is something that that I've even contributed to in any even a minor way, but I'm going to give you sort of a theorist's perspective, or at least my perspective, on what is the LHC doing, what is it telling us, okay? And so there are three universes. Usually they tell you a colloquium should only cover one topic. I'm gonna cover three universes, so it's sort of a, okay? All right, so the outline of the talk, I'm going to first of all put this in context of the story of the weak interaction. So this is really a story which is going really far back to the 1930s, actually. And the puzzles that really originated here directly in the 1930s have led to the proposed to through three different, completely different paradigms for fundamental physics that grew directly out of trying to understand the weak interactions. And finally, all these years later, the Large Hadron Collider is the experiment that's actually where it's actually possible to decide between these things, okay? And then, of course, the most famous discovery of the LHC so far, the Higgs boson, I'll talk about that and talk about what did we learn in the context of this broad context here, what did we learn from that, okay? Okay, so the weak interactions. The story of the, why are the weak interactions interesting? They're weak. Well, the thing that makes them important, one of the things that makes them very important in particle physics is it's the only fundamental interaction that can change particle type. So this is the sort of modern table of the elements. It lists all the elementary particles that we know about, except for now the Higgs. But most of these particles actually are unstable, okay? And all these with an X are unstable due to the weak interactions. And the ones with these arrows can mix with each other under the weak interactions, okay? So the weak interactions sort of stomp all over this diagram and tell you that the only particles that are actually, there are only a few particles that you actually observe as particles. The rest of them are all mixed up by the weak interactions, okay? And it's also responsible for beta decay and, as I said, mixing of neutrinos. And it's responsible for one of the crucial interactions that powers the sun. So life itself is, in some sense, dependent on the weak interactions. Okay, so in terms of the first attempt, the first sort of major progress in having a theory of the weak interactions is due to Fermi in 1934. And Fermi was a very practical person. He said, well, if protons, neutrons, electrons, and neutrinos interact in this way, I will just invent a new interaction for them. And I'll parameterize it by some local interaction term in a Lagrangian, okay? And people who were wiser and smarter than Fermi, like Oppenheimer, for example, said, this theory is silly. This theory is silly because according to your silly theory, the interaction strength grows with energy, and eventually it violates unitarity. And it violates unitarity at a scale, if you work out what the scale is, because this coupling constant that you could read off from the decay of the neutron, for example, you could read off what it is, and you would find that this energy scale where it blows up was a TeV of energy, okay? And so in 1934, people said, okay, that was silly, but Fermi had a more practical attitude. He said, that's great. This theory breaks down at a TeV. That motivates a collider at a TeV. We want to see what happens at a TeV, okay? Because this phenomenological theory describes what's going on at low energies. Let's see what happens at this magical scale, okay? And Fermi, actually, at the end of his life, he really did think about this, and he proposed what it would take to make an accelerator that could have a TeV of energy. And this is an actual drawing of 1954 in a lecture that Fermi gave to the National Academy of Sciences. And according to his calculations, you would need a collider that circled the Earth, right, the globotron. So back in the 1950s, people were not afraid to think big. It's interesting to ask, you know, Fermi was very, very good at these order of magnitude estimates. You know, we now know that you can make a much smaller collider. And the reason is that this was actually a fixed target experiment. That was the main reason. He didn't realize that you could, you know, that it would be technologically possible to focus beams of particles well enough that you could have two beams colliding with each other rather than a beam and a fixed target. Okay, so, but of course, since 1934, we've had an immense amount of theoretical progress, right? So instead of Fermi's theory where we had this point-like interaction, we now know that this point-like interaction is mediated by the exchanges of weak gauge bosons, actually W's and Z's, okay? And we know that the weak interaction is partially unified with electromagnetism. And this theory, which is sometimes called the standard model of particle physics, actually led to a prediction of these particles, their properties, and they were then confirmed. They were actually found in experiments. And we've also discovered that there's more to life than protons and neutrons. Protons and neutrons are made of quarks, and there are multiple generations. So we've sort of completed, well, we've found this sort of small table of elementary particles. So there's an incredible amount of progress made, okay? But this theory, all of the things that we've discovered in the theory, all the weak gauge bosons, all these new generations of matter, we still know is incomplete, okay? And the reason is that if we just take the elements of this theory that we know are there, or that we knew were there before 2012, because the Higgs boson doesn't appear anywhere on this list, right? So if we just take these particles and we take their interactions as given by this theory, and we scatter these W bosons off each other, we again get a cross-section that grows with energy squared. So this is, it's a different process, but it's the same E squared growth in energy that Fermi had in his theory back in 1934. And if you ask, where does this blow up? You find that it blows up at a TeV. And that's not a coincidence. It's actually the combination of parameters that controls where this blows up is exactly the same combination of parameters that came into Fermi's theory. So in some sense, you could say that we actually didn't make a huge amount of progress by replacing Fermi's contact interactions with exchanges of W's and Z's. The theory still breaks down at the same scale, okay? And yeah, this is what I'm saying. It's exactly parametrically the same thing as Fermi's constant if you work out the relationship between Fermi's constant and the parameters in this theory, okay? So again, we're motivated, again, since 1934, we've been motivated to have a TeV collider to understand what happens when the weak interactions are no longer self-consistent, okay? Well, we finally, in the late 2000s, we finally have this collider. It's the Large Hadron Collider. And probably you've seen, almost certainly you've seen this picture before. This is the Geneva Airport that sort of sets the scale for this. And this is, it does not glow in the dark. This is just a circle drawn on there. The detectors are immense, right? This is the CMS detector. For some reason, the label was left off. There's a person. Here's the Atlas detector. Here's a person, right? And this thing actually has an energy of, I guess, this, I should say 7 TeV now, and it will go up to 13, not 14, okay? But it will, so this is what we have right now to explore the TeV scale, and the main motivation really for building this is exactly what I've said, to understand this TeV scale, okay? Okay, so, so the model, as we've described it so far, is incomplete. That is, if we just put in the W and Z bosons and all the generations of matter, the theory is incomplete, but it's also been known for a long time that it has a very simple completion. Actually, it has many completions, but there's one that's by far the simplest, the standard model. It's the simplest completion because it adds only one new particle, a single spin zero Higgs boson, and it has only one additional parameter that controls the interaction of this new particle with everything else. So the model is completely determined by one new parameter, which is the Higgs mass, okay? And so what is this theory? In this theory, we introduce a new fundamental scalar field. That's a new ingredient compared to what we've had before. And this scalar field has the property that it is turned on even in the vacuum. So the fields that we're most familiar with, electromagnetic fields, for example, they're only turned on if there are charges present. But in some sense, the Higgs boson is turned on even in the vacuum, in the ground state, and that's because the energy as a function of the Higgs field looks like this. It's not a minimum at H equals zero. It's actually a minimum when H is non-zero. And the role of this particle is that the masses of the elementary particles arise with interactions from the Higgs field, and since the Higgs field is turned on in the vacuum, they change the properties of the particles in the vacuum. So the masses of these W and Z bosons and the masses of the quarks and leptons that are the fermions in the standard model all arise with the interactions of this Higgs field, which is turned on in the vacuum. So roughly speaking, you can think of these particles as propagating through the vacuum and interacting with this non-zero Higgs field, and that generates their mass, sort of like getting slowed down by multiple interactions, okay? So before we, just a little aside here, you can wonder, well, you know, why did we have to add anything? Why isn't a simpler theory just to have, why can't we just somehow add a mass term? Why do we have to add this extra degree of freedom? And so one way for the W and Z particles, these are particles that have spin one. So they have the same number of polarization states. Well, if they were massless, they would have the same number of polarization states as a photon, which is also spin one. But a massive spin one particle, so you know that a massless spin one particle has two polarizations. You learned that in E&M, where you learned that an electromagnetic wave has two polarizations. But for a massive spin one particle, you learned about its polarizations in a different class, and namely in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, because if a particle has a mass, you can always go to a frame where it's at rest, and it can be described as a non-relativistic particle, and then a spin one particle has three polarizations, okay? So there's an extra polarization required if a spin one particle is going to get a mass. That has to come from somewhere. You can't just add a mass term, okay? And in fact, the extra polarizations come from the Higgs field, okay? So this is one way to understand why we had to add the Higgs field. For the fermions, it's a little bit different. For the fermions, in the case where a fermion is massless, then we still have the same number of polarizations, but they correspond to separate, they correspond to a fermion and an antifermion. And if you have a non-zero mass, the fermion and the antifermion can mix. So there's a new effect that comes in when the mass is non-zero. And it turns out, because of the couplings in the standard model, this fermion-antifermion mixing requires an additional interaction. Okay, you can't put it in directly with a mass term. Okay, and these interactions arise from the Higgs field. So the interaction structure, or in this case, the spin structure of the standard model, means that you can't just add a mass for everything. It actually has to come from some dynamical effect. And the simplest version of that is the Higgs field. Okay. So the amazing thing is that theoretical physics really works. The Higgs boson was first proposed in 1964, just a few months away from the time that I was born. And now in 2012, on July 4th, 2012, the discovery of the Higgs boson was announced, both by the ATLAS and the CMS collaboration. This is only one of the, it was actually discovered simultaneously in a number of different modes. The Higgs boson has very, very intricate properties, which are all predicted by this one parameter, the Higgs mass. And so the fact that that this long-awaited particle, you know, something consistent with this long-awaited particle was discovered in many different modes was, you know, a real vindication of more than 40 years of very hard work by very many people in particle physics. And, you know, the CERN auditorium was a place of great celebration at that time, if it's only appropriate. Okay, so you can say, okay then, that's it, right? I mean, the most simple theory had one missing ingredient, okay? It was discovered last year, okay? So this is the close of some big chapter, okay? So now I want to try to explain why, nonetheless, despite all of these things, we think that this theory is not complete, okay? And so to do that, I want to say something about how we think about theories that are incomplete, okay? So this goes under the name of effective field theory, okay? And so the idea of effective field theory is very ordinary in physics. It's just the idea that we think that, you know, there's probably any given theory that we write down is not exactly true. There's probably some underlying microscopic theory. So for example, in fluid dynamics, there's an underlying atomic microscopic description and so on. And in the standard model, at the very least, We haven't explained quantum gravity, and we expect that at some very high scale, new physics, possibly string theory, maybe grand unification, or something comes in. Okay? Now, having new physics at tiny microscopic scales doesn't usually mean that the predictions of our theory are nonsense. I mean, in some sense, our theory is completely wrong because maybe it's replaced by little vibrating strings, but it can still be a perfectly valid, effective description, right? It can be an approximate description at much lower energies, okay? And so a systematic way to think about this is just to assume there's some heavy scale M, which is going to be at some scale, let's say, too heavy for us to probe directly, like the Planck scale or something like that. And we just expand our Lagrangian, or the interactions that we have, can just be expanded in powers of this parameter, okay? And the pieces that are M to the zero, in other words, the pieces that are dimensionless and don't depend on this parameter, are called marginal. The pieces that depend on as inverse powers of this heavy mass are called irrelevant. Here, this can be understood because if they depend on inverse powers of some heavy mass, they're bound to be small because some other scale has to, you know, compensate for this in the numerator. And if this is a very, very heavy scale, these will surely be small. These are dimensionless couplings. These are what people used to call renormalizable, and some people still do. It's a fact that the beautiful renormalization theory of quantum field theory applies to these things. So these are the theories that sort of make sense in and of themselves. We now understand that just from the point of view that we can take this M to infinity and these go away and these are all that's left, okay? So anyway, the marginal terms, these are the terms in the interaction terms that we can write without introducing any scale into the problem. These interaction terms in the standard model are a triumph. This is what the triumph of the standard model is all about, because these things here have predict the couplings of the W's and Z's, the so-called gauge couplings, all these patterns of intricate patterns of mixings from the weak interactions. There's a huge amount of phenomena that are predicted all by these couplings, and these have all been confirmed as accurately as they've been measured. It's a real spectacular triumph of the standard model. And in fact, it's not just, in fact, the standard model is so good that given the symmetries of the standard model, you just simply write down everything that you can. And that is what defines this theory. And the experiments fix the parameters, but also give you many, many relationships, many predictions that are, you know, there are many more predictions than there are parameters. And so this is a great triumph of the standard model, okay? These terms right here, these so-called irrelevant terms, they're small, but it turns out they're also important. It was pointed out a long time ago that if you go to the next order in this expansion, if you go to higher order in M, there's exactly one kind of term you can write down that has a 1 over M in front of it. And this is a term, an interaction between the lepton fields and the Higgses. And if you work out what this thing does, it gives rise to neutrino masses and mixings. So it is true that the discovery of neutrino mixing was a phenomenon beyond the standard model, but it can be accounted for by some new physics that arises at some very, very high scale. So there's a natural, it fits very naturally into this framework, okay? Okay, so again, all of this says, great, everything looks fine, the standard model works as an effective field theory. There's just one little problem for something that I've left out here, which may be obvious to you, but that is, what about positive powers of M? I didn't think about whether there are any terms that have positive powers of M, okay? Well, there is exactly one, and it's the Higgs mass, okay? So this is called a relevant term, okay, because it's generically, it's very big. So just by dimensional analysis, if I just say, okay, well, there's this dimensional analysis I've been using, let me apply it to this thing too, well, then it's a total disaster, because it would say that this mass is of order, I don't know, the Planck scale or the unification scale or some huge scale like that. But that's, of course, not what we observe. The Higgs mass term has to be much smaller than that. It has to be, so the Planck scale, if the Planck scale is 10 to the 19 orders of magnitude, the mass scale that we want is 10 to the 19 GeV. We want 100 GeV, and it's actually the mass parameter squared that enters into this. So there's some insane hierarchy here that just completely disagrees with dimensional analysis, okay? And the problem is, you might say, oh, okay, well, all I need is I just need this term to be small. Maybe there's some a symmetry that makes it small. Maybe there's some extra symmetry when it's zero, and then if that symmetry is broken a little bit. But the problem is that this mass term is allowed by all the symmetries. Okay? And in a little more detail, this mass term is not exactly the mass that was measured at the LHC, which, by the way, is 125 GeV. It's not that mass term. This is actually the mass term that controls the quadratic behavior of the potential near the origin. So if it's positive, the Higgs-Webb is zero. If it's negative, this is the value of the Higgs in the vacuum. If it's negative, the value of the Higgs in the vacuum is of order m Planck. And so here, all the particles are massless. Here, they all have masses of order m Planck. It's a pretty bad situation, right? Okay? And so there is, of course, a very, very special value tuned to some 30 orders of magnitude or something, which agrees with experiment. So if you're just fitting to experiment, you can say, well, I just don't care. I'm just going to fit this parameter to experiment, and that's it. But that is, if you think of this as this parameter as something that you can control, that's living very, very close to a second order phase transition or a critical line in the parameter space of this theory. Okay. Now, the way I've described this here, you might think that, okay, but this is just somehow dimensional analysis. And that is the way that I have described it to you. I've described it to you like it's just dimensional analysis. But it turns out that you're just going to have to kind of trust me on this, that the more you think about this, the truer it is, that there's just no way to avoid this problem. If this relevant term is allowed by all the symmetries, it is just going to be there. Okay, quantum fluctuations generate it, et cetera. Okay? And so, like I said, the analogy I would think of is that suppose, you know, you walked into a room and turned on the lights, and there on the desk there was a pencil that was standing on its tip. What would you think? I don't think you would think, well, it can happen. You know, 1 out of 10 to the 32 times somebody throws a pencil on the table, it might just stand up. Okay? Right? I don't think you would think that. I think you would say, well, somebody glued it there probably as a joke, right? That's probably what you would think. In other words, some force is actually holding it there. There's a reason why it's there. It's not just there by accident. And that's the same, in the same sort of sense, even though this is one faint clue, this smallness of this parameter relative to its natural size motivates that there's some new forces, something new and something about the that we have to add to the standard model to explain why this parameter is small. Okay, so this naturalness problem is basically the thing that I'm going to be talking about. The people thinking very hard about this naturalness problem have come up with three completely different paradigms for this. Okay, one of them is supersymmetry, which I call logos, compositeness or extra dimensions, which I'll call stratus, and the multiverse, which I'll call chaos. So I'll describe these things, and the motivation will become clear. And just to sort of give you a roadmap so that you're, what I'm going to tell you about each of these things is I'm going to tell you why they're such a great idea, why you might think, oh yes, this has to be right, this sounds so great, and then tell you why it actually, the closer you look at it, the more it looks a little bit like a bummer, okay? And then at the end, and we'll do that for each of these three things, and then at the end we'll see what the LHC has to say. Okay? That's what I'm going to do. All right, supersymmetry. Okay? So here, this is, to a theoretical physicist, this is like catnip. This is the most beautiful sort of solution you could imagine. We're going to eliminate the sensitivity to the UV with a new symmetry. I told you that this H squared term is invariant under all symmetries. And that's only true if you're not incredibly clever and you invent something called supersymmetry, which is actually a new space-time symmetry, which somehow changes bosons into fermions. So it's not something you can think of as a continuous rotation, but mathematically it has the structure of a symmetry. And that's why this thing is subtle. Okay? So it implies, since this transformation relates bosons and fermions, it tells you that bosons and fermions have equal masses according to the symmetry. Okay? And remember, I told you before that if fermion masses vanish, there's an extra symmetry. Actually, I don't know if I actually said that it was an extra symmetry, but there is. The fact that these particles and antiparticles don't mix means that there's an additional symmetry in the problem. Okay? So having a light fermion is not a problem. I didn't tell you that there's a problem with the electron mass being small, for example. Okay? And so in a theory where the Higgs mass is related to a fermionic Higgs mass, then there's, it's very natural to have the Higgs mass small, okay? All right. And this supersymmetry has an incredibly beautiful mathematical structure, and it's the thing that, you know, I think that as a theorist, you would definitely want to vote for this in terms of sheer aesthetic beauty. And the reason I call it logos, logos is from the Greek reason or word. It's sort of like the old Greek picture that, the you know, we live in this sort of crappy earth place where everything's dirty and complicated. But in the, there's some celestial sphere, and outside of that, everything is beautiful, and the mathematics becomes beautiful, and so on. And so that's sort of, if supersymmetry is right, that this is then we're going to be, you know, soon exploring this more supersymmetric, more beautiful world than the world that we, you know, seem to be living in. So what does supersymmetry actually look like? You know, the catch is that, well, one catch is that you have to take all the particles that we know and you have to add these partners of them that have different that are you know, for bosons you have to introduce a fermion, for every fermion you have to introduce a boson. Turns out you can't relate the bosons and fermions within this in any way, even partially, because they just have different interactions. Okay, and so, and you have to add actually two Higgses and their associated partners, so you have to add a whole bunch of stuff. Okay. And the symmetry certainly cannot be exact because, for example, there's no scale, there's no bosonic electron that has the same mass as the observed electron, for example. And so this symmetry has to be broken in such a way that it still explains why the Higgs mass is small. It doesn't have to be zero anymore, but it has to be sufficiently small. And all of these new particles, if they were light, we would have seen them, so they have to be sufficiently heavy. And if you make, of course, if you put you can easily imagine that if you put these things at the Planck scale, you haven't done anything, right? Because what will happen is that the Higgs mass will be then set by the interactions of these things will feed into the Higgs mass and give you a Higgs mass of order of the Planck scale. So if you work out what it is, these things can only be, have to be roughly speaking at the TeV scale or below if you want to solve this naturalness problem. And as a bonus, it turns out that the lightest of these partners, of these new particles that you threw in, is naturally stable and can be a good dark matter candidate. Okay, so I'm not really going to talk about dark matter, but let's mention that. Okay? Okay, so this sounds great, right? I mean, this sounds like this is it. Okay, why would we look anywhere else? A beautiful new symmetry, you know, this thing makes this thing natural. But is it really natural? Okay. So the minimal version of this, which is something that something like 90% of beyond the standard model physics is devoted to this one model, the minimal supersymmetric standard model, it's already unnatural because of the failure of particle experiments. It was already unnatural in 2000 when the LEP experiment, also at CERN, failed to find the Higgs boson. Okay. And it turns out that as a result of just that fact, the failure to find the Higgs boson, here's the sort of a priori parameter space of this minimal model. We have to live on this purple line. And what is this purple line? It's precisely the boundary between the region where the VeV is zero and non-zero. Remember, that's exactly what I said was the tuning of the Higgs mass is, right? It's, you have to tune very close to the boundary between where a Higgs VeV is, where the Higgs, the value of the Higgs in the vacuum. I keep saying VeV, that's the term of art, vacuum expectation value, where the Higgs value of the Higgs in the vacuum is zero and where it's non-zero. And you know, away, if you go too far away from this thing, the Higgs VeV is too big. If you go away from this, and the thinness of this line is how much tuning you have to do. And it's actually thicker on here than it is in real life. It's actually something like a percent level, okay? And it is exactly, if you work out what is causing this, it's exactly the effect that I talked about, namely that the quadratic term in the Higgs potential is sensitive to masses of heavy things, okay, heavy scales, in this case, the stop quark, the partner of the top quark. And it's about a 1% tuning, okay? So supersymmetry was already not very natural in 2000, and you can see from this that the problem gets worse the more, the heavier the supersymmetric particles have to be. Okay, and the LHC has not turned up, has extended the reach of being able to see these guys to much heavier mass scales up to, these are actually not the most recent plots, but I haven't heard any rumors, so I'm sure there aren't any discoveries, to something like, it's complicated, there are many parameters, but a rough figure could be something like 1.5 TeV, at least in the simplest models. We haven't seen any super partners either, okay? And we have seen the Higgs, and I'll discuss the implications of the Higgs for all of the scenarios that I'm talking about at the end of this talk. Okay, so SUSY looks great, but it actually has the problem that it was meant to solve, and we haven't seen any of it yet. Okay. So let's move on to universe number two, compositeness. Okay, this is a very, very different idea. Rather than saying, oh, we have some fundamental new symmetry, we just say, we just have sort of another layer of structure, kind of like what we've already seen. Atoms are, in some sense, the fundamental constituents of chemistry, but the atom itself is a composite object. It has electrons orbiting a nucleus. The nucleus is a composite object. It's made out of protons and neutrons, but protons and neutrons are themselves composite objects. We now know they're made out of quarks. The electron, it seems, as far as we know, is elementary, but there's no reason why shouldn't this sort of keep going? There could just be more and more structure. The more we probe to higher energies or shorter distance scales, we just keep seeing more structure, okay? And the TeV scale could just be associated with some new substructure like this, okay? And we've certainly seen this before. QCD, people started uncovering all these many particles, new resonances, and things like that. And it turned out that these were not elementary things. They were just, again, some complicated structure arising from a new interaction, okay? This is still universe number two, even though it sounds very different. Another idea you could have, which sounds completely different, is extra dimensions. Okay, what could be more different, right? Compositeness, things, big things are made out of little things, and extra dimensions, okay? So just bear with me. You'll see the connection in a second. What is the idea of extra dimensions? The idea of extra dimensions is that we live, for example, we human beings and our photons and the things that we interact with may be restricted to a subspace, there could be extra dimensions of space that we don't see. And the reason we don't see them is just because they're very, very small. So in sort of fundamental units that particle physicists use, their length scale would be given by the same TeV scale that they're associated with the weak interactions, okay? Now, one easy way to see why we wouldn't see these things is we can look at excitations of fields that are confined to this extra dimension here, okay? And if we look at the modes of this field, the modes will have some profile in the extra dimension, and a flat profile basically has no, derivative energy, right? And so would correspond to something that could be massless. But any mode which is actually turned on in the bulk of this extra dimension will have a mass that is generically set by the size of this extra dimension. And so we would have a sort of unexcited state that could have a very small mass. This would have a mass of order TeV. The next excitation might have a mass of order 2 TeV, and so on. Okay? So if you're an experimentalist, okay, forget about being a theorist. If you're an experimentalist and we live in a world like this, what would you see? You would see that, well, we could be made out of these things, so the particles that we see could correspond to these things, but then there could be new particles that correspond to these, and these would just be a bunch of TeV resonances, okay? And there would be an infinite power of them because we can make more and more excitations. That looks very much like QCD. When QCD was discovered, you first found, we knew about the protons and neutrons, and we found pions, and then we found kaons, and all these other resonances, and it seemed like there were more and more particles, but then all of these things were excitations of a fundamental theory, just like these are excitations of an extra dimension, okay? So again, this connection may appear from what I've described to be sort of superficial. Okay, you've got two theories that both have lots of particles, but again, it's one of these things where it turns out that the more you think about this, the deeper this connection is. It doesn't turn out to be more superficial. And in fact, there are very specific examples where, in a very precise way, extra-dimensional setups like this are related to very specific, strongly coupled quantum field theories analogous to QCD and so on. So it's not just that these look the same to an experimentalist. The more theorists think about them, the more they look the same to us as well. Okay. But in any case, I'm lumping these things together because they both would imply a lot of new structure at the TEV scale, and it turns out they're also theoretically very closely related. So this kind of a scenario I would call stratus, okay, which is from the Latin, it means a cover or spread, low-lying cloud. So the idea is here, we're not about to poke our heads through this celestial sphere and see the beautiful world of supersymmetry or spherical mathematics or something. We're just seeing yet another layer of structure. That may be how the world works. Okay. The earliest version of this was called Technicolor, which was originally based on copying the dynamics of QCD. There are many variants of that. The main prediction of this class of theories is that there's no light Higgs boson. So those theories are now officially and completely dead. Okay. And they were actually declared dead in 2011 by Nimar Khani-Hamed, 1 year before the Higgs was discovered. But that's another story. Okay, but there are still perfectly good versions of this idea that are not quite the minimal type of scenario that accommodate a light Higgs. So in these cases, the light Higgs can be light because it's an approximate Nambu-Goldstone boson. I'm not going to explain exactly what that is. It has to do with the fact that it is an excitation, just like I drew the Higgs potential before. You can have a more complicated Higgs potential that has a sort of a valley going around like this, the so-called Mexican hat potential. And the fact that this valley is shallow corresponds to a light mode. The mass of this thing is, it gets a mass by giving the potential a slight tip. And this sort of a setup is very natural. In fact, it occurs in QCD. The pions are slightly tipped Nambu-Goldstone bosons. So that's again, analogous to something that we've seen before, okay? So what kinds of models and signals do you have here? I'm just going to flash these. These are more or less words, but there are various specific incarnations of this idea. They go under the name of composite Higgs and little Higgs. And these all predict, in addition to the Higgs particle that we've now observed, these things predict additional structure at sort of the TEV scale. Okay? But, as we said, only the Higgs has been found so far. Okay, that was universe number two. Let's stretch a little bit. Okay, so the third universe, this is really going to date me, but behind curtain number three, the last universe, the multiverse. Not just one universe, the multiverse. Okay, and the motivation for this comes from a completely different direction. Okay, so I told you, remember I lied to you when I didn't tell you about the Higgs mass being a relevant parameter? Well, I lied to you even then, because there's another parameter in the standard model which is even more important in this counting. It's order m to the fourth. Okay? So remember, the Higgs mass was order m squared, where m is some heavy scale. And the thing that's even bigger is just a constant term in the Lagrangian. Okay, so normally a constant piece in the action corresponds to a shifting the potential by a constant. That doesn't do anything except in the presence of gravity. It turns out in Einstein's relativity, this gravitates. Okay, so this term, it's the biggest thing there is if you believe that there's any new physics in the world, and in gravity there certainly needs to be, and this term is even more relevant. Well, what does it do? What it does is it tends to make the curvature of our universe be set by this scale. Okay, so the bigger this scale is, the more curved our universe is, the smaller our universe is. So just the fact that you can see me already right now puts enormous bounds on this thing. The fact that you've heard my entire talk without being crunched into a tiny ball, or the fact that the universe exists for as long as it does, puts insane bounds on this parameter. So if I write it as some scale to the fourth, it's 10 to the minus 12 in these GeV units, right? So remember, the W and Z masses are 100 GeV. We're exploring the 10 to the third GeV scale now. So this naturalness problem is way, way worse than the one I described before, many orders of magnitude worse. And just like the Higgs mass, there's no way to forbid this term. Okay, there are a few caveats that the experts will know, but let me not pause on those. And they're really, unlike the Higgs case, I just showed you two solutions to the Higgs naturalness problem, okay? So, and maybe you can argue there are a couple more that I've left out. Somebody might complain, well, you didn't put in my model, my solution to that, and I have left some things out. But there are no known solutions to this. This naturalness problem is so hard that the problem is there is no known solution to it, okay? Okay, so what is our attitude towards this, okay? Is naturalness, maybe naturalness is not a correct principle. So I'm going to describe to you a line of thinking, okay, about this that, well, we'll see where it leads. And in a sense, it's radical conservatism in the sense that it really tries to stick with the things that we know, try to introduce as, try not to change the rules as we know them, okay? So string theory, which just was arrived at in attempts to understand gravity and the unification of all forces, seems to have within it some astronomical number of different distinguishable ground states, okay? Estimates of around 10 to the 500, a number that one can't even imagine how big that is. And each of these vacua are different, so they would have different ground state energies, they would have different Higgs masses, different couplings, all the parameters would be completely different. So people try to make vague pictorial things of this, so this is supposed to be a potential with all these different minima, which, kind of hard to see here, okay? Each one of these minima is different. So this is sometimes called the landscape, right, because this looks like some insanely peaked mountain range, okay? And it turns out that you can actually tunnel from one of these vacua to the other. And you can have bubbles within bubbles in the expanding universe. Different bubbles can be in these different vacua. And so in a sense, the expansion of the universe naturally populates this landscape so that you have different regions of the universe that live in different of these vacua. And these different regions, because they expand, you can't see into one region from another. So we may just be living in the middle of some region, say here, and there might be, we might be inside bubbles of this vacua, and we might just not know it, okay? And this is called the multiverse. Now, this is a bit ahistorical, but this kind of picture where there are many possible universes that are somehow realized, okay, and we just live in some random one, this sort of a picture led to an actual prediction. I mean, one of the things that people say when they hear this kind of stuff, and one of the objections that you often hear is that, well, it's not science. And why isn't it science? It's because it cannot possibly make any predictions, okay? But there was a prediction made in 1987 from these ideas, and I'm just going to describe it to you, okay? So Weinberg noted that, well, if we think about something like this, and we think about somehow an ensemble of universes, all that have different values of this cosmological constant lambda, there's something the striking that happens because this lambda dominates the expansion of the universe at late times. The bigger lambda is, the sooner the universe starts undergoing this some kind of rapid inflationary expansion, and such universes will not have galaxies because basically the gravitational expansion will pull apart galaxies before they have a chance to form, okay? And so if you imagine that there's some distribution of possible universes that we could be living in that all have different values of lambda, there's only actually a tiny band around lambda equals zero that is compatible with structure. By structure, I mean the existence of galaxies, okay? And this whole picture may sound like fantasy, but one thing that isn't fantasy is where this line is, right? Where this line is just computed by saying, okay, let me consider a universe with a different value of lambda, and let me just see, whether galaxies would form in that universe or not. So what Weinberg did is he figured out where these lines are, okay? What value of lambda is compatible with structure. And it turns out to be very close to this value, which is the current bound. In other words, we are very close in 1987, I'm describing what was known then, this bound, the biggest that it could possibly be, is very close to the bound on just the fact that the universe exists, okay? So that's actually very interesting, okay? So I'm getting ahead of the game. So the argument is that somehow it's roughly speaking, it's sort of equally likely for the cosmological constant, roughly, to have any value, okay? This value is not preferred by anything, but except that all these universes that live out here don't have any structure in them. So we could not possibly be in that universe. Life did not evolve in these universes. Life evolved in this kind of a universe because that's the only place in this multiverse where life could have evolved. So the fact that we wake up in the morning and see stars, that we see galaxies, is just because we live in this, we live in one of the universes in this little band, okay? So if you believe in that, right, it would not make sense for there to be a further coincidence that the value of the cosmological constant you see is much, much smaller than this bound, because roughly speaking, now with this additional constraint, every value in here would be roughly equally likely. And so you would predict from this that actually the cosmological constant would be not many orders of magnitude away from this bound, right? And that was, in fact, what was observed later. And so the credibility of this prediction is very largely enhanced, I think, first of all, by the fact that it was Steven Weinberg who made it, but also the fact that he did not like it at all. In fact, he said, this is a great opportunity. We can rule out this horrible type of argument, this sort of anthropic argument. We could rule it out if we just don't see a cosmological constant in the next round of experiments. But the next round of experiments, it wasn't quite galaxy counts, but supernova counts, found actually an accelerated universe that could be described by a cosmological constant. So Weinberg was forced to conclude that there was actually evidence for this idea rather than ruling it out. Okay, so that's the cosmological constant. We might still have the excuse that, well, what does that have to do with the Higgs? The Higgs is gravity. But the thing is that similar arguments can be made for the Higgs mass parameter, the other parameter in the standard model that is UV sensitive, that is sensitive to these high scales. Because remember that the physics changes drastically as a function of MH, right? If MH is, the point is that if MH is not slightly negative, that you can argue that the universe either doesn't have baryons or doesn't have complex nuclei. Okay, the universe is completely different. So now it's not the existence of galaxies, but more the existence of stars, the existence of chemistry. These things are very sensitive to the Higgs mass. Okay, and so what you have is you have a picture that's very similar to the one I drew for the cosmological constant. A priori, the Higgs mass can be anything between 0 and M Planck. But unless it's very close to 0, okay, close to the observed value, these universes don't have any chemistry. So we could not live in those universes either. The fact that we wake up in the morning means that we live in one of these universes, okay? And again, this bound is very close to what we actually see. This thing would be falsified if we ended up somehow very, very close to zero, much closer than where this the edge of this curve is, but that isn't the case. So if we believe in this kind of thing, it's a little bit, it sort of takes your breath away if you're a particle physicist who spent, you know, 20 years working on physics beyond the standard model motivated by naturalness, because in this framework it seems that there's no need for any physics beyond the standard model. Maybe the standard model is it. The Higgs is the true completion of the electroweak theory. But to say the least, there are problems with this. One thing that sort of you actually see that you're going down kind of a rabbit hole if you think about these ideas is that you can ask the question, well, what parameters are actually scanned? You know, what I said before is quite true. If I hold every parameter fixed except one, and I vary that one parameter, and then I see what happens. But in the string landscape, we actually expect, from all the evidence that we have from string theory, all these different universes are completely different from each other. They're just completely different from each other. And so everything varies, okay? So what is the relevance of that? Well, the relevance of that is there can be universes that have structure but in very, very different ways by having combinations of parameters. So for example, we can send the Higgs mass to the Planck scale if we have other parameters that vary to compensate. Okay, so that's one very, very big problem with this kind of framework. And also, it's extremely difficult to verify or falsify it. You can get this sort of evidence that things look sort of right, but it's very hard to get sharp predictions from this kind of framework. There have been some made with some additional assumptions. So there are some, if you add some additional information or some additional assumption to this picture, you can in some cases make some sharp predictions. But in general, it's very hard. Okay? And so this is what I call chaos. Chaos, the word chaos originally from Greek meant formlessness or confusion, and that's kind of at least how I think of this sort of thing. I'm not sure what to make of it. It says that the universe is not the way it is because of some beautiful order. It's essentially random, and we live in the only place, part of the universe, where we can live. Okay, so in the last 5 minutes, I'm going to talk about what does the LHC say about all of this, okay? Well, the first fact, striking fact about the LHC is that they've looked not just for the Higgs, of course, they've looked for everything. This is a multi-purpose experiment, multi-purpose detectors, collaborations with thousands of people, all working day and night, working very hard. And this is just some tiny subset of the searches that are not for supersymmetry, okay, that have been done. And it just tries to summarize the searches by a single each search by a single number, which is very simplified, and just saying what energy scale does it probe. And on the left side, you have various different models, which are all more or less versions of one of the ideas that I've described before. And you look for something that was predicted there, and you hear in this case, you haven't seen any color octet scalar diejet that would show up in diejet resonances up to about 1.2 TeV. And then, you know, there are many, many searches like this, okay? And basically, there's, despite a huge message I'm telling you is that despite a huge number of searches and many, many different channels, there's been no sign of any new physics, except, of course, the Higgs, okay? But this is what I would, my verdict on this would be that it's still early, in a sense, okay? We're still only running at 7 TeV. We're still having a run for, we're going to go to higher energies, we're going to run longer, there's going to be a lot more reach. There's plenty of places where natural theories that could have escaped these searches. And so there's still plenty of room for the sort of physics that's predicted by the first two scenarios that I talked about to show up in these kind of searches, okay? All right. The LHC Higgs discovery is a different story because it's very definite, right? There's something that was discovered. So let's see what does it say about these big grand questions. And it's interesting because the Higgs is such a central part of this story that it actually is very, very different in these three universes. So if we have this last possibility that I said, this multiverse tuning, then we would expect just the standard model Higgs boson. And remember, the standard model has only a single additional parameter, which was the Higgs mass, which now we know is 125 GeV. So now there are no more free parameters. So this is an incredibly predictive theory. It predicts exactly what the Higgs must look like. Okay? If it's supersymmetry, supersymmetry requires additional Higgs bosons. That sort of flashed by very quickly, and I didn't explain why, but it actually requires additional Higgs bosons beyond the single Higgs boson. So that those additional Higgs bosons can actually mix with the one that we observed. And so the detailed predictions, the couplings, for example, of the Higgs that we observed are in general different in supersymmetry from the standard model. Okay? And finally, for the composite Higgs, the Higgs properties are different because the Higgs is not an elementary particle. It actually came from this compositeness or some extra dimensions. And that, again, will modify the Higgs couplings. And these two kinds of modifications will, in general, have different patterns. Okay? So the Higgs is actually a great laboratory for testing these ideas. Okay? And the point is that actually it turned out that the mass, 125 GeV, that mass for the Higgs was a very, very, nature was very kind to us in the sense that for that mass, and it's not true for other masses that the Higgs could have had, the Higgs actually has roughly comparable strength couplings to a number of different modes that are observable. So you don't just observe this particle and see one particular decay. You actually see many different decays and production modes at the same time. And so there are many different probes. Okay. So this has now become an industry, okay, of understanding the Higgs couplings, the detailed properties of the Higgs, to see where do they agree. And I'm just going to show you a rough idea of where that subject is, and that'll be the end of my talk. So the way these results are usually presented is that we just normalize the various couplings that are important relative to the standard model. So a value of these C's of 1 means that it agrees exactly with the predictions of the standard model. That's our reference, okay? And so, for example, in a model like in a model where you have multiple Higgs bosons, like in supersymmetry, then it turns out that there are there's a sort of an a priori parameter range, okay, for these CB and CT. Those measure the coupling of the Higgs to bottom and top quarks. The standard model sits at 1, 1, and it turns out that the minimal supersymmetric standard model has to live in this green region up here. Okay? So the point is that the minimal supersymmetric standard model occupies a very specific region in this space of couplings. Okay? Now what does the data say? Okay, so this is hot off the press from Morionde. This is what the data says in that same plane. So here is the standard model. Okay? And these are 1 and 2 sigma contours. Okay? So you see that if you want to believe in the MSSM, okay, you are somewhat disfavored, okay, by the data. Okay? Now, it's not, there's a lot of complication here. You know, this is not yet at the level of statistical significance. Particle physics, we have an extremely high standard for statistical significance because the experiments are perfectly repeatable, right? And so, you know, we can make very precise statistical statements, and this is not yet at the level where people would want to make a claim. But, you know, the best fit value is very, very far away from what supersymmetry would predict, okay? And actually, there are actually no, it's actually not so, if you really took this point seriously, it's not so easy actually to fit it in any model. So I think that rather than say that there's some big crisis, what I would say is that this shows you that experiments, you know, as we nail down these errors, and as and they will get nailed down by quite a lot, this could say something very, very interesting. Okay, so we're already learning a lot from the Higgs. And this plot, I just want to advertise, this is made by Alexander Azotov in Galloway. I have a personal connection to these guys. I've worked with both of them. I taught this guy quantum field theory, and he was a student at UC Davis. And these guys have a very beautiful review on how you do this kind of stuff and the implications of this kind of measurement for new physics, which I highly recommend if someone's interested in digging into this more seriously. Okay, so that's it. That's where we are. That's how I see it, where we are at the in particle physics right now. What I would say is the LHC is the crucial experiment for telling us what kind of world we live in. That's been true since 1934, okay? And we have these three completely different scenarios of the way fundamental physics might work. I tried to tell you that each of them, I think, looks plausible when you start looking at it. Then the more you look at it, maybe it starts looking a little bit more fishy. And oh, that's it. That's my talk. Okay, thank you.
So we like to give students an opportunity for the first questions. Are there any student questions? Okay, why don't I throw it open to non-students as well for questions?
Last week, we had a colloquium from Paul Steinhardt, and he went through inflation, the theory of inflation, step by step, and ended up saying that it has to be eternal inflation.
There has to be what?
Eternal inflation.
Eternal inflation, yes.
Which is multiverse inflation. And he made some very critical statements about this. He didn't like it. So you have suggested that he said that the inflation, according to this scheme, has no predictability whatever. I'm quoting him.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert in inflation. There are certainly versions of eternal inflation that do make specific predictions. Whether the framework as a whole makes predictions, that may not be true. But you know, I think, I don't know, I think people could, people, you can have a very, very long argument about whether these sorts of theories, these multiverse theories, really make predictions, whether they are predictions, whether it's science. But to me, I don't think that the universe cares very much whether we can make predictions. You know, I really don't. And so to me, it's not a question of, you know, is it science, is it cricket, is it, you know, it's just a question of, is that the way the universe works, or isn't it? And to me, it doesn't seem crazy. I mean, it has some conceptual problems, but if a universe, if a multiverse exists, then these kinds of considerations are important, right? So whether they explain things or whether they predict things or so on, I don't know. But I don't know. Unlike some people, most people, a lot of people seem to have a very violent reaction to these things. They either think, oh yes, it solves everything, or it's total crap. I guess I'm somewhere in the middle. I can see that this could be the way the universe works. It could be important, even if we don't like it. So that's my attitude.
Thank you. So a very nice talk. I'm just, I guess, curious. There are different comments. I mean, I guess the thing I'm curious about is that where do you think neutrino masses play here? I mean, which, do they support any of these ideas?
Well, the one place I mentioned neutrino masses is that they do fit very well with this idea that you know, the standard model is a generic effective theory whose parameters, except for the two that I talked about, are controlled by dimensional analysis, in the sense that you can account for, not explain, but you can account for neutrino masses by adding the leading subleading operator, you know, to the standard model. And you know, this was noted a long time ago by Weinberg. So I think that the way neutrino masses fit into this is that there are many of the sort of finer details of the standard model that we don't understand. So even before neutrino physics, there was the pattern of quark and lepton masses. And quarks mix with each other in the same way that neutrinos do. Now that we've discovered neutrino mixing, we have more of that sort of phenomena to explain. So I haven't really talked about that because it seems like there are some ideas about how to do that, but there don't seem to be sort of sharp contradictions, because you can so easily accommodate these phenomena. They don't lead to sharp questions where you question the standard model itself. So I would say that those are, they're interesting things where there's a lot of structure in the standard model that you would like to understand, but it's not something that, like these things, which really challenge the standard model itself.
But just the fact that the dimensionful parameter that enters the neutrino mass operator, it's at such a higher scale, doesn't it say that maybe we shouldn't expect beyond the standard model physics at TEV?
Well, it says that we shouldn't expect any beyond the standard model physics for what causes neutrino, mm-hmm. causes neutrino, whatever gives rise to neutrino masses. And similar statements can actually also be made if you're trying to explain the quark and lepton masses. There are other, it's a little different story, but there are also indirect indications that if you want to associate that with some new high-scale physics, that new physics had better be pretty far away. It's a more complicated story, but it's a similar kind of conclusion. And so, again, it's a question of, you know, it's an interesting question to account for those, but they are not hints for new physics at accessible energies, exactly as you say. Mm-hmm. Whereas these sorts of puzzles, you know, hint at physics at accessible energy scales, and that's why I focused on them.
Okay, thank you.
So of these three options, where is the smart money? How would you rank their likelihood in some order? Are you going to remain fully agnostic, which I would interpret as one chance and three for each?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'll answer your question. So, if you want to talk about the smart money, one way you can answer that is you can say, you know, so there have been all these experiments, you know, going back at least to LEP in 2000, where you spent ever more money and ever more experimentalist man-hours trying to find things that were predicted by these natural scenarios. Okay, the only thing that was found is the Higgs boson. Of these three scenarios, the only one that's looking better and better rather than worse and worse is the last one. Okay? That's just a statement of fact. Okay? So you might, you know, so in fact, in the community, a lot more people have been thinking about things like this, okay, as a result of this fact. It seems that we're being pushed into that, in that direction. But if you ask me personally, another way to ask this question is, what am I working on? I'm working on this, okay? Why? Partly because, logos, supersymmetry, okay? The reason I'm working on this is just to do with the fact that I think that's my job. In other words, I think my job is, we are testing this idea of naturalness, and so part of that job is pushing, trying to see, you know, how you know, whether you can implement it in some more clever way or something like that. But truly, I am pretty agnostic in the sense that I would be equally happy with any of them. I mean, I just want to know the answer.
You mentioned that the Higgs boson has been found last year, but from what I understood, a new particle was found, but they weren't sure if it was the Higgs or not. So I was wondering what the consensus is on this issue.
So I think there's a very, very strong consensus. I mean, it is true that, you know, in some sense, a new particle was found, okay, but the new particle was found many properties, a fairly large number of properties of this particle were all discovered at the same time, okay? So different ways that this particle could appear, which in the experiment look completely different, right, that are all related by the Standard Model, were found around the same time at the level predicted by the Standard Model, okay? So that is very, very striking evidence. Now, if you take just one of these ways that it was found and say, you could say, oh, well, there's 125 GeV resonance in this channel. Is that the Higgs boson? Well, it could be something else. But there was another 125 GeV resonance found in this other channel, and with this relative strength correctly predicted by the Standard Model. So it's true that there is still a lot of room for deviation from that, but it's actually shrinking very rapidly, okay? So the previous question was about the smart money. The smart money is overwhelmingly on the fact that this is a Higgs boson. That's what I would say. So, and as we accumulate more data, we will certainly be doing more precise tests of whether the properties are the ones that we expect from a Higgs boson. There have been a few things like this. So, for example, it's been ruled out that the Higgs boson has spin 2, okay, rather than spin 0. That's been experimentally ruled out already. That's fairly easy to rule out. Other more, you know, things that maybe there's more than one Higgs that happens to have, there are two states that have masses very close to each other or something like that, those will take more data to test. Yeah.
So you listed three options there, but there's an obvious fourth one, which is none of the above, that you alluded to somewhat.
Yeah.
Could you flesh out what none of the above is? At least give.
That's what I do for a living, right? I mean, we're always, I think, when you come to a crucial moment like the LHC, I think it's a time when you take stock of, you know, where you are and you try to focus in on the essentials, and that's what I've tried to do here. I mean, yeah, we always are hoping for we're really hoping for something better than all three of these. And I hope I made these seem sufficiently unattractive that you see the motivation for that is clear. But the problem is just we've been thinking about it for a long time, and I think this is the best we've got.
So alluding to the previous question, is your deep feeling that really it is a fourth thing and none of those?
I don't have a deep feeling. A part of my response to this situation is to go and work on black holes. Seriously, because I'm really confused, and I'm trying to do the best I can in this kind of physics, but it's hard to know what to think. It really is. It's a puzzle.
Thanks.
Any further questions?
So this is a pedagogical question. Mm-hmm. Why does the mass of the Higgs tell us about What's a chemist? What is, how is it related to chemistry?
Yeah. So there are two signs for the mass of the Higgs. Okay. And the one that's easiest to understand is, if, let's suppose the Higgs mass, the quadratic term and the potential were negative, as it is in nature, but it was just much larger, okay? Then what would happen is we would have a much larger value for the Higgs field in empty space, in the vacuum around us. And the consequence of that is essentially that all the masses that we observe would scale up, okay? Now, it turns out that the existence of nuclei is closely connected with these small mass differences that we have. The fact that the mass differences, well, and the masses of quarks are small, okay? And if they were much larger, you can just take the theory and you can compute what happens to them, and basically the nuclei don't exist, okay? So, but you can see from that description that it's crucial that I keep all the other parameters fixed, because, you know, in this theory, the mass of these quarks, for example, is essentially given by a coupling strength of that quark to the Higgs field. So if I crank up the value of the Higgs field in the vacuum, but I crank down that coupling, everything can change, okay? And so there are relatively simple patterns of that change which preserve things like the existence of complex nuclei. So that gives you some idea of what goes into that.
One more comment. It seems that if this new boson is indeed the Higgs boson with quantum numbers of the vacuum, which is quite extraordinary, I still have some issues about that, but these are detailed issues, as you pointed out. Then we're led into what Steven Weinberg calls his worst nightmare because of what you've explained, which is strange, because nature gives us this particle which causes all this trouble, potential trouble.
Yeah, so you're asking me to comment on Steve Weinberg's worst nightmare? I don't know. I think particle physicists are, I think that saying that discovering the Higgs boson is your worst nightmare is a measure of how perhaps, and this is nothing against Steve Weinberg personally, a lot of people, that sort of a comment one hears quite frequently, actually, among particle physicists. Frankly, I think that's just a measure of how high our expectations actually are, that we think that discovering something like the Higgs boson is a bummer. I mean, I think it's incredibly exciting. We are learning a lot. I think we're maybe not learning what we had hoped to learn, okay? I mean, especially here, you know, people are very eagerly anticipating discoveries, and so far they haven't emerged, and so there's a natural effect from that, and I think Steve Weinberg in particular was probably expecting this kind of discovery as well. So, yeah, it's not my worst nightmare, I would say.
Okay, I think let's thank Marcus again. Thanks.